From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a first-hand account of what it's like to be autistic. Donna Williams is an autistic woman who is also remarkably articulate. She's written an autobiography about living in what she calls a world under glass. And we talk with Dr. Bernard Rimland, a psychologist who specializes in autism. He was an advisor for the movie Rain Man and wrote the foreword to Williams' book. He started researching autism after the birth of his autistic son. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Porcupine, a new novel by the British writer Julian Barnes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council is considering using military force to protect relief shipments to Somalia. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali presented the council with a list of five options today for dealing with the situation in Somalia. Three of those options included the use of military force. Boutros-Ghali did not rule out an American offer to commit up to 30,000 troops to the effort, but indicated that he'd prefer a force led by the UN. Humanitarian aid shipments to Somalia have been almost routinely stolen by bandits and by troops of the various clan factions. President Bush placed a call to Russian President Boris Yeltsin today, in which the American leader expressed U.S. support for Yeltsin's reform program. The call comes on the eve of a crucial meeting of Russia's Congress of People's Deputies. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Yeltsin will face numerous challenges to the speed and scope of his economic reforms, and perhaps even to his own leadership. According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, Mr. Bush is worried about the opposition facing Yeltsin because, as Fitzwater put it, we've worked hard for the reforms in the former Soviet Union, and we want to promote them in every way we can. During their 10-minute conversation, President Bush assured Yeltsin that, quote, we stand behind you and the others promoting economic and political reform. Yeltsin may need all the support he can get once the conservative Congress begins its session. Russia's high court today said Yeltsin partially overstepped his authority when he imposed a blanket ban on the Communist Party after last year's coup attempt. And one of his communist critics says the ruling will be used to try to impeach the Russian president. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Former Democratic presidential candidate Paul Tsonga says he'll begin chemotherapy to treat a recurrence of cancer. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Paul Tsonga says he feels healthy, except for a painful 6-inch incision in his stomach. The 51-year-old former senator underwent a surgical biopsy a week and a half ago to diagnose a lump in his abdomen. Tsonga says the test showed that the tumor is cancerous, an apparent recurrence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, with which he was first diagnosed in 1983.
The good news is that it's contained, that every other test they've taken cannot find any trace of it anyplace else.
During this year's primary campaign, Tsonga often spoke of his apparently successful battle against cancer with the help of a bone marrow transplant. Tsonga says he's not sure what effect the cancer's recurrence will have on his long-term prognosis, but he intends to continue his work to reform government, and he won't rule out a future run for the presidency. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
Stock prices were up sharply today on Wall Street in what analysts said was a response to strong retail sales at the start of the holiday season. The Dow Industrials gained 23 points to close at 3,305. This is NPR. Senator Bob Packwood has entered an alcohol treatment program and hired an attorney to defend him in a possible Senate ethics investigation of sexual harassment allegations against him. An aide to Packwood said the Oregon Republican has no intention of resigning. Packwood's chief of staff, Elaine Franklin, said that the senator voluntarily entered a one-week treatment program yesterday. She declined to identify the treatment facility but said the program involves blood tests and therapy. 10 women who worked with Packwood over the years have accused him of making unwanted sexual advances to them. As of today, there are three Brazilians who bear the title President of the Republic. As NPR's David Wellner reports from Rio de Janeiro, there's some confusion in Brazil about just who's in charge.
When acting President Itamar Franco left Brazil today for a trip abroad, he left the presidency in the hands of the head of Brazil's lower house of Congress. Meanwhile, Fernando Collor, the man Brazilians elected as their president 3 years ago, still holds the title of president. But ever since the Brazilian Congress impeached him 2 months ago, Collor has been removed from his functions. He now faces a trial in the Brazilian Senate that could eject him from office definitively. In the meantime, acting President Franco is refraining from taking any major policy initiatives. But the acting president, who's standing in while Franco's out of the country, lost no time today scheduling top-level meetings to push forward his own agenda, raising doubts about who's calling the shots here. Collor's lawyer, meanwhile, denied reports today that his client plans to flee to France. I'm David Wellman in Rio de Janeiro.
The United Nations Security Council has imposed trade sanctions on those parts of Cambodia that are controlled by the Khmer Rouge faction. The sanctions are intended to force the Khmer Rouge to disarm as part of the UN-sponsored peace process. The resolution also threatened to exclude the Khmer Rouge from Cambodia's first free elections in May. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Autistic people can't usually describe how they feel. This makes it very difficult for others to understand the autistic world. That's what makes Donna Williams' autobiography so unusual and so valuable. After being labeled deaf, retarded, disturbed, and insane, Williams wrote the story of her life when she was in her mid-20s. She gave it to a child psychiatrist, hoping he would read it and tell her what was wrong with her. He sent it to a specialist in autism and passed on a copy to a publisher. It's just been published by Times Books. Williams was born in Australia in 1963. Her mother didn't understand Donna's condition. She was ashamed of her daughter and abused her. Donna Williams left home at the age of 15 to get away from her family and managed to find work and live on her own. Autism is believed to be caused by a neurological dysfunction. Autistic people find it hard to process information, everything from language to facial expressions, touch, and other human cues we take for granted. They also find it difficult to adjust to change and to anything new. Before my interview with Williams, her representative at Times Books suggested I send Williams my questions in advance so she could interpret them and think about them. I also spoke with Williams on the phone before the interview so she could get accustomed to my voice. She warned that if I asked the questions out of sequence, she would lose me. But if I told her the number of the question I was skipping ahead to, she could probably follow along. She brought a portable computer into the studio with her to write down any new questions I asked. And she told me it's easier for her to write than speak.
The first thing of that I want to say is that when you talk about writing, there's a difference between handwriting and typing. Typing is less time-consuming, so the awareness of the amount of effort that you put into self-expression, it causes, with handwriting, a greater degree of shutdown. When I'm typing, my thinking flows better and the retrieval of words is easier. It's a lot easier than speaking because there's also less emotional overload and less direct social involvement. With typing, what happens is as I'm thinking, I'm spelling out the words that go to the pictures in my head. And it always involves exactly the same action, which is just the hitting of a key, which is different to the writing of letters with handwriting. And so there's no battle informing anything as it comes out. And so the speed of expression is quick enough to get out without any blockages. If I... when I type, I hit the keys, but for me, my conscious awareness doesn't process it as self-expression. It doesn't get enough time. It just says, I'm hitting keys. It's the keys that are talking to the page. And because of this, I'm often not aware that I'm thinking at all until it appears on the screen in front of me. So it kind of bypasses the conscious processing, which is much, much harder with speech and involves a lot more mechanics with speech and more awareness of emotions and having a self and other at the same time. Also, for me, 1 hour's writing is the same equivalent as perhaps 1 hour of your talking, but 1 hour of my talking is like about 1 hour of my talking is like if you were talking for about 5 hours. It's like going through a fight, and every word is like dragging the words out of the mud.
Donna, this will be question number 4.
Mm.
When you were a child, You used to dream about spots of color. Were those spots of color in your waking world also?
When I rub my eyes, yes. When you rub your eyes and you look at the light, you can see those spots. Anybody can. But I suppose for me they were more intense. Same, they still are more intense now. The slight variations in colour on something to someone else can strike me very strongly. The other thing that there was little sparkles everywhere in the air and like whooshing round. And what they actually are charged energy particles that are dancing and whooshing around on the airwaves. And that's caused by having very hypersensitive vision. And I understand that some of that is related to the fact that meaning is not being processed. So these things are like the foreground and everything else is so irrelevant. For me also, I think that in fact it was so enclosing. It made me feel part of all this dancing light is very, for me, was a very beautiful thing. But I do think also that the ability to focus so totally in such a single way is because of a lack of sensory integration. Otherwise, I'm sure I would have been putting all sorts of incoming things together instead of being so highly focused on little charged energy particles.
Do you think that you still see or hear things that other people don't?
I think that I see colour and reflection far more intensely than other people. I don't think I see anything that's not there. I just see things that take other people a much greater degree of focus, and the things that are usually background information for them that they've began overlooking years and years ago is still often I have to fight to not make it foreground. And what's more is the response I have to this. For me, it gives me a very intense emotional and physical response, and other people hardly respond at all, let alone be captured or very moved by those kind of things.
Sometimes you test to see if someone is real. How do you test?
I found this a very strange question. I didn't really understand this question. I'll say what I think, though. I think that sometimes people aren't real because they're being superficial and they're so tied up with doing and saying what they don't mean. There's nothing genuine about them. Sometimes I will sense people. It's a kind of, I call it their life music. And sometimes you can tell that it's not in line. Everything they're doing is not in line with what you sense of who they are. I can't understand who they are, but I can sense who they are. And it's like they kind of feel dead, like they haven't got a self, like their whole repertoire is who they think they are. I think that's when I was also about 13 was the first time that I realized that people were not exactly meaning everything they said and did. And when that realization hit me, I didn't have the language to explain. I walked around saying, everybody's plastic, and hitting myself because I was trying to say they're superficial, they're not meaning what they're saying. My disappointment in the possibility of a predictable world or a world of guarantees was really shattered when I realized that people were not real in that sense. Can you understand me?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. What else frightens you or makes you uncomfortable about other people?
One thing I think is, again, to do with touch. With me is probably emotions and touch are the most difficult. Some of that comes to do with body awareness, and what happens, for example, is I have just recently learned that when people touch one part of themselves to another, they feel it in both. I learned this when I said to somebody, I was very shocked that my leg had told my hand where it was, because over the years, only my hands told my leg where it was. You understand? Not that the other way.
Right.
And that progressed to one day they both felt it, and I just was really shocked. I thought something had gone very wrong. And this made a lot of sense to me to why things like touch were so difficult for me to interpret, even from a physical perception point, let alone closeness and the social connotations, everything. And the fact that my perception of my body is in bits. There's other things such as the self and other problem, which means that it's hard to work out who's doing what to whom, who's doing the wanting, who's doing the accepting. It's not all working for me. There's not a lot of interpretation of physical sensation. There's either my eyes are turned on here and I can see it coming, or there's the physical interpretation, or there's some emotions but no physical interpretation. It's all very mono. Other things like touch hypersensitivity make it very frightening, because it can send me through the roof. Even having someone walk past me, if my touch is very hyper at that time, it's like even touching myself is a torture. And it feels like if it goes higher than that, it's like overload. And if it goes into shutdown, I end up feeling as dead as the table. If I hit the table and I hit myself, I can tell the difference by the texture of the object that I'm hitting. But the inner sensation, forget it. So the interpretation inside is anger and betrayal, because it feels like the other person has killed you off. And when they think this is closeness or this is love, or they then want you to say, oh yeah, that was great and I really like you too, it is so alienating and really frightening that how different they are. Or if you say, no, they're not different, they're the same, which is often what they tell you, then you think, they must be crazy. Why do they do this if they're the same, if this is their perception? Also, it's very hard sometimes to get all the mechanics going to say, I don't want this. First, you've got to interpret a not want. And to do that, you've got to be able to read your own body messages. So it means I'm very vulnerable in company of other people. When those people think they like me or something, you're much safer with people who don't give a damn.
What are some of the things or some of the activities that give you the greatest pleasure?
I don't know how silly this will sound. Crystal chandeliers, pink streetlights. What else? I like the ocean at the night time. I get very excited about the ocean of the night. I think also being with people who can communicate with me in my own way, with no struggle.
My guest is Donna Williams. She's an autistic woman who has just written her autobiography called Nobody Nowhere. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donna Williams, the author of Nobody Nowhere, the autobiography of an autistic. Where do you live now?
I live outside of London in a village.
Do you live with someone?
No. I have a friend who comes and stays sometimes. It's good because we're like brother and sister, and neither of us, we don't have, because we're the same, we are like each other. In that he also has the same kind of difficulties as me. So there's no expectation of what do you feel for me, or, and there's no interest to touch each other, or even we don't interpret the shape of each other. We are just, that's what we look like and that's that, and there's nothing else. There's no attraction, there's no nothing. So there's no fear that anyone's going to exploit anyone or look for things that aren't there or wish that they were there or take the other person's response or lack of it as a reflection on them. You understand?
Yes.
So it's good, really good.
Do you know many other autistic people?
I know quite a lot of autistic people because, for one thing, because of the book, but also through a couple of networks that link up autistic people with one another. The people I've met are all very different from each other. I share some things in common with some and some different things in common with others. My best friend is somebody I share most things of my system in common with, even though our interests may be different sometimes. But generally, they're more easy to communicate with. Most of them I communicate with by writing. But what makes it easy for us to communicate with each other are things like having a shared system, sometimes shared interest, especially shared past experiences of family relationships, schools and jobs, shared physical responses or the lack of them, and that shared incongruity with the system values and definitions of non-autistic people, like with things like closeness or touch or sexuality or communication. And also non-autistic people may find us interesting, but it's usually some idea of we're either special good or we're special bad. But with each other, with one autistic person with another, we are generally much more accepted as we are. I have a saying which I think for me captures that, and that is that normal is to be in the company of somebody else like yourself. And when we're with each other, we feel normal.
I understand, I think. Yeah. Donna, would it be okay if I asked you some questions that were not on the list now?
Well, you can ask me them and I'll see if I can work out what I think or understand.
Okay. You've referred to a state of total shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe what it feels like to be in that state of shutdown?
Hold on. I'm holding on to your question here. What does shutdown feel like?
Yes.
I describe that because for me, many things are very single track. It's like everything is on a scale. And if you imagine that scale is from 0 to 5, then most people's highest point is 3. So if they feel emotions, for example, their most extreme emotions are 3. After that, your body starts to shake. After that, you can't process the meaning of what's happening to you. After that, it's like going slowly into a state of shock. And that's what happens for me. But the kind of experiences that give other people a sense of 3 can give me a sense of 5, which means that the physical response looks like having a fit. Every part of my body will be in tremors. It feels painful to feel that emotion. And then the only way over that is a complete, like, it's like walls go up. It's like going into a state of shock, and next thing there is no meaning, but at least all the pain's gone. You feel dead. But for me, this happens also with my vision. It happens with touch. It happens with hearing. So when the meaning drops out of vision, first I'm very affected by what I'm seeing. Then next thing I notice, I have no interpretation of the colour, shape, pattern of what I'm seeing. There's no putting together with what it means, what to do with it, anything, until it is so frightening. It's like being meaning blind, and meaning deaf is the same. So all the words in the world can't help me. Nothing is familiar. You say a word to me, cup, I won't know what it means. It's just a sound. It's a series of sounds, and I'll keep trying and trying to put it together, and I can't. But what leads to that is this feeling of sounds being so heightened that they tickle me. They can be very exciting. And then next thing, the meaning is slowly dropping out until there's none there. If you get all those kinds of shutdown together, including the retrieval of words for language, you're in big trouble. It feels like hell, feels like death, and you're just totally terrified. It's like being buried alive.
When was the last time that happened to you?
Maybe... Oh, I know, 1 week ago. And my friend was with me, and he helped bring me back with my sense of smell and rhythm. I couldn't make sense of who he was or what he meant to me. All I knew was that the visual impression of this person before me was familiar, and that the sound of his voice was familiar, even if I couldn't comprehend. And then he had me smell his hair, and I just said his name, and I knew who he was because that system was not shut down. And I just smiled. I felt okay. And then I saw things like the traffic. But when it's like that, all you see is this whoosh and shapes and color, and it frightens you. You could just as easy run in front of it. So when he helps me to get breathing, get rhythm going again, get settled into a pattern, next thing to put the words back together with what I'm seeing, and the connection gets made. It's like being born, and you're so happy to be back. It's really good. It's really great.
Do you remember what set off that shutdown?
Yes. At that time, it was that I'd walked in I was in an unfamiliar place, and that was okay because I was at least with familiar people, and I either need familiar people or familiar place. If I'm missing the two, I'm very vulnerable to this. But what happened was then someone else came and joined us, and that person, I couldn't instantly communicate with them directly, and it was not deliberate. It was an automatic response to refer to him as he and to address him through the person I was familiar with. And he just got very angry, and he said, "You'll look at me when you're speaking to me. I'm not him, I'm," and he told me his name. And he started giving me a kind of a very fast-talking, act-normal lesson in 5 minutes. And he was speaking so fast, his movements were all unfamiliar, his intonation was all unfamiliar. My emotional reaction was going zoom straight from basic up to five. Everything was hitting at once, and that was it. I started to shake. I couldn't comprehend. And my friend, just who happened to be with me, just said, indicated to me to come on. And I left with him, and he helped me back out of it. But by that time, I'd gone from overload into shutdown.
I think I've asked you the things that I most wanted to ask.
Yes.
And I think you might be tired anyways.
Yes.
You don't sound tired, but you told me before that talking for an hour is a very long time for you. So
put it this way. I just know you said tired, talking for an hour, and long time for you. Is that some indication?
Yes. thank you very much for talking with us.
Goodbye, Terry.
Donna Williams' new book is called Nobody Nowhere, The Autobiography of an Autistic. On the second part of our show, we'll be joined by Dr. Bernard Rimland, founder of the Autism Research Institute. His son is autistic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Bernard Rimland became the father of an autistic son in the 1950s when autism was blamed on bad parenting. Dr. Rimland's research is credited with overturning that theory. Dr. Rimland is the founder of the Autism Research Institute. He was the technical advisor on autism for the film Rain Man, and he wrote the introduction to Donna Williams' autobiography. We'll talk with him about his research and about being the father of an autistic son. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Porcupine, the new novel by British writer Julian Barnes, set in Eastern Europe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says that the UN has no choice but to use military force to ensure the delivery of relief supplies to Somalia. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
In a letter to the Security Council, Boutros-Ghali gave tacit approval to a recent Bush administration proposal to send U.S. troops to guard relief supply routes in Somalia. Boutros-Ghali said the situation in Somalia has become intolerable, with the country's warring factions making it virtually impossible to get food to the starving people. He said the only way to control the crisis was for foreign troops to guard relief supplies. He said he preferred that the troops go in under the command of the U.N., but he acknowledged that countries may be reluctant to give up control of their own forces. Bush administration officials have said privately that U.S. troops will only participate in the operation under U.S. command. Boutros-Ghali also said the U.N. must look into ways to restore civil authority in Somalia once the hungry people are fed. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
In Washington, the Commerce Department has imposed tariffs on steel products imported from 10 countries. It's the latest action in the increasing friction between the United States and its trading partners. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The Commerce Department's action today was in response to complaints filed by the country's top steelmakers in June. They charged that foreign steelmakers are unfairly subsidized by their governments. Those subsidies, they claim, enable foreign steelmakers to sell their products at lower prices, giving them an unfair advantage over U.S. manufacturers. In today's preliminary ruling, the Commerce Department agreed with the U.S. manufacturers, and it imposed tariffs on steel imported from countries such as Belgium, Brazil, Germany, France, Italy, and South Korea. Companies who want to buy steel from those countries, automakers for instance, will have to pay a penalty of as much as 50%. The Commerce Department will issue its final ruling on these and other cases by April. At that time, the temporary tariffs imposed today could become permanent. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
Also in Washington, for the first time in 20 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to consider a major abortion controversy. By a vote of 6-3, the High Court has voted to sustain a basic right to abortion ruling in connection with a 1990 Guam law that would have banned nearly all such operations. In June, the nation's highest court reaffirmed the center of its finding in Roe v. Wade that women have a constitutional right to abortion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 23 points to close at 3,305.16 on volume of 330 million shares. This is NPR News. Heavy fighting has been reported in Bosnia as ceasefire violations continue. A regional ceasefire accord was agreed to last week, but in a new violation, Serbian artillery shells are said to have hit a town in Croatia. Meanwhile, officials say that two UN peacekeepers have been seriously wounded in a landmine explosion in Sarajevo. Firing also occurred around the capital's airport. However, aid flights continued. According to local officials, more than 17,000 people have been killed in Bosnia since the fighting began nearly 8 months ago. Reaction has been muted after a ruling from Russia's highest court that largely upholds Russian President Boris Yeltsin's decrees against the Communist Party. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
After 4 months of testimony, the Russian Constitutional Court ruled that Yeltsin acted legally when he banned the Communist Party's hold on governmental power in Russia. but that he exceeded his constitutional authority when he outlawed all activities of the communists. The court ruled today that the party is legal at the grassroots level and free to engage in activities like any other political party. Former communist leaders hailed the court's decision as a victory for their side and immediately announced that they would take steps to reconstitute the party, which broke up into several groups after last year's coup. But Yeltsin's supporters also welcomed the court's decision. One of his attorneys said the party will never be able to reconstitute itself as anything other than a marginal political party. Another praised the court's ruling not so much as a victory for Yeltsin as president, as for Russian society as a whole, which he said is learning to resolve such disputes in a normal legal fashion. This is Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The government says that the nation's trade deficit climbed to more than $26 billion in the third quarter for an increase of 8.1%. The Commerce Department says that the widening of the federal deficit was the biggest in nearly 2 years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Dr. Bernard Rimland started studying autism 36 years ago after the birth of his autistic son. Since then, he's consulted with parents of autistic children from around the world. Dr. Rimland is a research psychologist and the founder of the Autism Research Institute. His book, Infantile Autism, is credited with redefining autism from an emotional disorder to a neurological one. Dr. Rimland wrote the foreword to the autobiography of Donna Williams, who spoke with us on the first part of today's show. Dr. Rimland was also the technical expert on autism for the film Rain Man. I asked him what autism is.
I was afraid you were going to ask that. there is no simple answer. The simplest answer, the quickest answer I can think of when someone asks me that question is to ask if they saw the film Rain Man. If they say yes, then I say, well, then you know what a relatively high-functioning autistic adult is like. If you can envision what that individual was as a young child, then you know what autism is. Other than that, it would just take, paragraph after paragraph of description to try to explain. Autism, in as few words as I can manage, is a very severe disorder of cognition, brain functioning, and emotion that occurs in very early in life, often at birth or soon after birth, never after age 3. It always is evident before age 3. Which is very disabling, even though the person is physically very normal and very often very attractive in appearance. No one really understands what causes it, except that it is known that it's a brain disorder. That's a very important point, because at one time, for many decades, in fact, it was believed to be an emotional disorder. The kids looked so normal that it was easy to believe that they were biologically normal and that they were merely emotionally disturbed. And, of course, that caused a tremendous amount of guilt and shame and problems with the parents when they were blamed by professionals for having caused their child's disorder. It is now known that autism is definitely a brain disorder, although the exact characterization of the disorder still is a little bit in the future.
I want to get back to that point a little bit later. You mentioned the film Rain Man, and you were a consultant to that film. In that film, Dustin Hoffman plays someone who is autistic but has this incredible gift. He's brilliant at numbers. Do you consider Donna Williams to kind of be in that category, but instead of numbers, it's language?
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy. Yeah, she's got an enormous skill with language, which is very unusual in autism because language is one of the great disabilities in autism. Quite a number of autistic individuals do have the very kinds of skills that Dustin Hoffman portrayed, not only skill with numbers, but with memory. You remember he was able to memorize phone books and sports statistics and all kinds of other things. And that is memory skill and numerical skill. And so other kinds of skills are very common in autism, but not a language skill.
Now, you have a son who is autistic. Do you feel like you got any insights into your son from reading Donna Williams' book?
Yes, I did. My son is now about 36 years old, and he does speak, but he certainly doesn't have anywhere near the power to explain himself that Donna Williams does. So it was really extremely interesting to me. And I do understand better what my life must have been for my son from having read her book. It was a very valuable contribution.
What specifically do you feel you understand about him now that you didn't before?
Well, the perceptual world is so different to the autistic individual than the normal person. Things that seem very commonplace to me apparently have very different connotations and implications and perceptions as far as the autistic individual is concerned. My own son has some of those kinds of things that he tries to explain, but he's not all that gifted at explaining it. One thing he is very gifted at, which it sort of astounds people, is in art. He learned how to paint when he was about 27 years old, and has started painting and drawing and doing artistic things, not autistic, but artistic. And now his paintings are very avidly sought after by collectors and displays and exhibitors of all kinds. So lots of autistic kids do have unusual gifts, but very few have the kinds of literary gifts that Donna Williams displays.
Donna Williams described how uncomfortable it is for her to be touched, how invaded she feels when somebody touches her. Do you think your son goes through that too?
My son seems to have recovered to a major degree from those kinds of problems. When he was small, you couldn't pick him up. He would scream and scream and scream as an infant. If you try to pick him up to comfort him, he would scream, you know, all the more. Made it extremely difficult to deal with him. But as time has gone on, that extraordinary sensitivity to touch has been greatly alleviated, and he no longer experiences it. Part of it may just be maturation, and part of it is due to the fact that I have been experimenting with a number of biological treatments for him, including the use of high-dosage vitamin B6. He's been taking high-dosage vitamin B6 ever since 1968, and he began to improve on that, and I think his very high level of functioning now, maybe I shouldn't say very high, his high level of functioning now is in large part attributable to that. I've been involved in the vitamin research now for all those years, and now there have been 16 studies published in five countries, all of which strongly support the use of high-dosage vitamin B6 in the treatment of autism.
I want to get back to touch. It must have been very hard for you and for your wife as parents to realize that your son didn't like to be touched as a child.
Well, he was our first child, and we had no idea what kids were like, but it was really very, very traumatic. He not only didn't like to be touched, his environment had to be very, very constant. In other ways, you asked about the perception that Donna Williams talks about. An incident occurs to me. We had an impossible time finding babysitters because he screamed and carried on so much. The only people that would work as babysitters were my mother and my mother-in-law. And yet he even screamed and made it very uncomfortable for them. He was so difficult that my wife had to do all of her shopping through the Sears catalog. And she noticed that whenever she changed dresses, he would become very upset. So she bought a series of dresses from the Sears catalog, all of the same pattern. And then it occurred to her to get several sizes larger of the same dress for my mother and several sizes smaller for her mother, so that whenever we took our son Mark to Grandma's house, whichever grandma it was, they would put on that dress in advance, and he would look at and notice that the person holding him had that pattern on, and he would quiet down. He was that sensitive to changes in his perceptual environment.
Is it still that way with him?
Oh, no, no. He's very, very, very much improved, extraordinarily improved. When he was 5 years old, we were told to institutionalize him, that he was totally hopeless, he would never amount to anything, and just forget him. But that isn't our way of doing things, so we just fought and worked, and now we have a very fine, still handicapped, but very fine, productive, pleasant son.
My guest is Dr. Bernard Rimland. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Bernard Rimland, founder of the Autism Research Institute. Your son is 36 now. When did you realize that there was something wrong?
Well, in retrospect, we realized it in the hospital. Just after he was born, all the other kids in the nursery were just lying there. They'd cry a little bit when they got hungry, but he didn't. He just screamed lots and lots of the time. Screamed so violently that my wife could hardly nurse him. And it was very difficult to placate him with anything. He just acted as though he was in constant pain or terror all the time. Now, some research that we're doing here in the U.S. and was started in advance on sound sensitivity in autistic children. It has occurred to me that perhaps he was one of those autistic children, and it's fairly common in autism, who have hyperacute hearing, so that any slight sound that is perhaps unpleasant or maybe not even noticeable to some people could be very painful to him. And anyway, that's one hypothesis as to why he screamed so much. We don't know, but it was very difficult, very, very difficult time.
Much less was known about autism when your son was born. You've said that you had a PhD in psychology at the time, yet you didn't know what autism was.
I was 5 years beyond my PhD in psychology. When I ran across the word autism for the first time, my our little boy was 2 years old at the time, and he was physically very normal looking, but he would walk around the house. He had started to walk without ever crawling, and he'd wander around the house repeating words in a hollow monotone, avoiding contact with everybody, tracking down the vacuum cleaner wherever it might be, playing with it for hour after hour. We took him to Grandma's house, and he'd run past her into the closet where the vacuum was held and play with the vacuum. All those kinds of things were very characteristic of autism, but we'd never heard of them. And my wife remembered once, one morning, reading about a child like this in an old college textbook. So when I got home from work, we went out to the garage and found the old box of textbooks and found that particular book, Child Development by Ames and Ilg, and found the chapter on childhood behavior problems. And there was the word autism for the first time, early infantile autism. And that this was, my son was 2 years old, and then he was born when I was 3 years past my PhD. So I was 5 years past my PhD and seeing that word for the first time.
How did you figure out that your son was autistic?
Well, he met point by point the exact description of autism that was in that book. It was just incredible because no one else, including our pediatrician, who had been in practice for about 40 years at the time, had ever heard of a child like this. It was just... we thought we had the only child in the world like this, and then I read the textbook, and here there was actually other kids like this, and it had a name. And so I began to track into that disorder. I found the went to the library and began to read, and I became obsessed with reading as much as I could about this very strange disorder. And at the end of 5 years, I had produced a book, and I submitted the manuscript to a publisher and immediately became the world authority on autism. Because everything else that was written from the standpoint that autism was an emotional disorder caused by bad mothering, what was called a refrigerator mother, a mother who just never defrosted long enough to hug her child or to love the child or to encourage a child, supposedly. And the child would react to this by saying, okay, you treat me that way, and I'm just going to turn autistic and reject the world and live in a world of my own.
Was it personally offensive to you and your wife?
Extremely offensive, not only to us, but all kinds of other parents as well. It's just devastating to first to have a child like this, to take the child to a professional and find that the child has a permanent disability, which will probably end him up in an institution. And beyond that, the reason that he has this, nothing can be done about it except drugs, which are not very good. But the reason for it is that you have some kind of a horrible personality defect that caused you to behave this way toward your child. And the treatment at the time was to put the parents in psychotherapy or psychoanalysis to try to find out what it was about them that caused them to reject their child so much, that the child would willfully turn autistic. And if the parents denied it, well, of course, that was, as far as the psychoanalysts were concerned, that was just proof that they were causing it. Denial was what was considered by the Freudian believers to be an admission of guilt.
You've used behavior modification techniques. What kind of can you be specific with us about what kind of techniques you've used and what you think the outcome has been?
Well, the biggest breakthrough that occurred in our own child's life when he was about 8 years old is when I discovered behavior modification, which was being developed by a number of psychologists around the country, particularly Dr. Ivar Lovas at UCLA, the psychology department at UCLA. And it involved the same kind of teaching techniques that were used with Helen Keller. Ordinarily, you teach a child by assuming the child can understand what you're trying to accomplish and that the child wants to please you. If the child is not particularly interested in pleasing you and really lacks the ability to comprehend, how do you teach them? Well, the answer appears to be, judging from the good results that are achieved, to use the same kinds of techniques that Helen Keller's teacher used in teaching her, little rewards and punishments. The rewards get by, you know, the vast majority of the attention rather than the punishments. But it's just like teaching a dog or a seal. You just reward them for what they do, and after a while they learn how to do it. In the case of autism, once a child learns that technique, learns that he can learn, and learn that he can be rewarded for learning, then the process becomes easier and easier for him, and he becomes quite proficient at learning, even though he doesn't necessarily understand as much as the normal child.
How much do you think you've tried to empathize with your son to really kind of get into his world, which is perceptually so different from your own? And is that one of the ways you've tried to reach him, or do you consider that virtually impossible?
We try the best we can. My wife and I are always discussing between us what, you know, why does Mark do this or why does Mark think that? And we try our best to understand and to compensate, but it is very, very difficult to try to place ourselves in his shoes. The Donna Williams book goes a little bit of a way toward helping. The main improvement that we can make by having read her book is not so much any specific details, but just the realization of how enormously powerful the impact is on the individual of being autistic. It is just hard to imagine until you read her book how extraordinarily pervasive this handicap is to every living waking moment and every thought.
Dr. Bernard Rimland is the founder of the Autism Research Institute in San Diego. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear today what UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali had to say about the necessity of sending troops to Somalia soon, and what a United States senator has to say about the prospect of U.S. troops going to Somalia. A special report from David Isay on the people in West Virginia who are called snake or serpent handlers, people whose religious observance includes handling snakes, putting them on their bodies, and they claim that their religion protects them from the serpent's venom. And also a talk with John Burns of the New York Times about his profile of a Serbian fighter who was responsible for many killings in Bosnia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times Magazine gave Julian Barnes the honorary title of Chameleon Novelist in recognition of the fact that few of his 11 published books have been on the same subject. He's written about death, obsessional love, world history, and literature itself. His latest book, The Porcupine, is about the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Barnes may have finally tried a subject that defies his quick-change artistry.
Some years ago, when that strange Peter Greenaway movie, The Draftsman's Contract, came out, I went to see it with a friend who was also at that time a graduate student in literature. When the movie was over, I asked her what she thought, and after a very pregnant pause, she said, "I didn't not like it." That phrase has always stayed with me because it so neatly encapsulated all the bad things I thought would happen to your mind if you stayed in graduate school too long. Namely, you'd become intellectually gutless, and your sentence structure would get all screwed up. Well, a few days ago, I finished Julian Barnes's novel, The Porcupine. I expected to rave about it because I loved his last book, Talking It Over, and because I like what's called the collage style of writing, a blend of fiction, literary criticism, footnotes, and satire that Barnes pulls off with ironic panache. But The Porcupine is much more spare, and when I finished it, only one phrase seemed adequate to convey the mild amusement and thin disappointment I'd felt while reading it. Believe me, I've struggled to find an alternative, but I'm afraid that the best and the worst I can say about The Porcupine is, I didn't not like it. The Porcupine is set in an anonymous Eastern European country that's mostly meant to be Bulgaria. It focuses on the trial of a deposed Communist Party leader named Petkanov. He's the porcupine of the novel's title because he's prickly and cunning, not old and remorseful, the way these guys often are when they're finally forced to account for their crimes. Petkanov acts as his own defense attorney, a dramatic situation that pits him against an ambitious prosecutor named Peter Selinsky. In the course of the televised trial, idealistic Selinsky stoops to a few dirty tricks of his own to get Petkanov convicted. This courtroom novel lets Barnes display his flair for crisp dialogue and his appreciation of political inanities. He invites us to chortle along with him as Selinsky recounts the events which led to the mighty Petkanov's overthrow. Apparently, the revolution was begun by a bunch of loony demonstrators who decided to stand outside a military installation one day and shout Dadaist slogans like, "Give us ideology, not bread," "Thank you for the price rises," and "Thank you for the martyrdom." Pretty funny. So what's not to like about the porcupine? For one thing, the conceit of having Selinsky the accuser see his own sins mirrored in Petkanov the accused is a musty, melodramatic gimmick. A more serious problem with the porcupine is that same absurdist take on Eastern European politics that I was just praising a minute ago. I'm not saying that because Barnes is British, he can't write about Bulgaria, any more than I think that women can't write about men, or whites can't write about African Americans, or vice versa. But sometimes the political humor here is too condescending, too slapsticky. It's reminiscent of the Marx Brothers in Duck Soup, yucking it up in old Fredonia. If you want to read a good Barnes novel on betrayal, I recommend Talking It Over. And his detective stories, written under the pseudonym Dan Cavanaugh, also give you a nice sense of the contemporary world gone wrong. But maybe Eastern European politics isn't Barnes' subject. As a political novel, The Porcupine is more nettlesome than incisive.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ojiva Blaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's World AIDS Day. We'll talk with Dr. Jonathan Mann, director of Harvard's International AIDS Center and editor of the first annual global report on AIDS, which has just been published. And we'll talk with playwright and activist Larry Kramer, co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.